the repolarization space mission. But Paolo wasn't able to come, so I'm going to try to also tell you a bit about the instrument and the foregrounds and sort of give you an idea about what's being discussed. And I mean, this is sort of an old topic. B-modes, the presence of B-modes dates to the early days of inflation. And so this is probably something that will most of you are experts on, and many of you are more experts than I at a lot of the instrumental and foregrounds aspects of this talk. But I'd like to give you an idea a bit about some of the choices and design considerations. Let's see. So before I start the talk proper, let me tell you a bit about the countries and people and people involved. So ESA has recently had a call for proposals for sort of all areas of space science. And BPOL is in the class M, which means that the ESA contribution has to be less than 300 million euros, and then the countries generally pay for the payload, the instruments, and then there's also the possibility of collaborating with other non-European Union countries. So basically, these first five countries are the sort of main European countries involved. But there are people from all over, and then one has a national coordinators, and then there were three working groups, and a lot of discussion on what sort of a satellite to propose. And the proposal, and a lot of with all the details and other documents, are available on this website. So I'm going to just run through the theory very quickly, just to sort of yes, it was submitted in end of June, and it's being refereed, and then we'll probably know at the end of the year. And there's, I should also mention, there's also expression of interest from basically all of the American groups who are interested in doing something similarly, and also from the Canadians.
Lumped into some group of large projects, or it's just in of itself, or how?
It's like MedX.
Yeah, MedX. There's LISA would be in the class L, which is sort of related.
But in this class, are there other? You can compete with anything.
Anything.
It's organized around the expense.
Right. Yes.
So presumably that wasn't the only
proposal in class. There are 50 proposals.
And one
will go up? Three will be chosen. Okay. Then it will go down to two. Then it will go down to one. But then you can also foresee that there will be other slots in the future. So
we got to look at the program is Cosmic Visions, right?
Yes.
But cosmic is kind of an expression. It's not as restrictive as you might
assume. Everything has a cosmos.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I mean, the I mean, when we look at polarization, I just show this, the theory behind the BMOS is particularly clean and doesn't really have very many assumptions in itself. We basically have the, Thompson scattering cross section, which is, very well known, and we measure the velocity of the photons on the last scattering surface, and then later the reionization. So one has many sources of primordial polarization, but it's really the Doppler shift from the shear, the velocity field that interests us for gravity waves. So we can make a list of all of the possible sources of the polarization and separate between E and B mode. And if we look at the B modes, well, the scalar depolarization has already been seen. Then we have all sorts of other contributions, but basically just symmetry arguments prevent the scalars to contribute to the depolarization of linear order. So that's why this is such a clean probe. We also have gravitational lensing, which is second order, so it can violate this, which is a big problem, but this is something that is pretty well understood, and we can figure out what it does and how we can deal with it. We have polarized foreground emissions, which we know some about, but particularly with the polarization properties of the dust, that's less known. Then one can also think of other more exotic sources. So cosmic strings are necessarily nonlinear and would be expected to create E and B modes sort of in equal proportion, just as foregrounds. We can think of other problems. If there are large magnetic fields of recombination, then that can change E into B, or there could be some complete surprise.
How big would the magnetic fields have to be a problem?
I'm not sure.
Well, you have to talk about topology, scaling.
That they would have a different spectrum. Okay, so what determines the E modes for the B modes basically is that the E modes can be represented as a scalar potential on the celestial sphere. So here it's a spherical harmonic, but then when we add everything up, we can just take this scalar function, take its double gradient, subtract the trace. And the other mode is the B mode, which is sort of like the curl or something rotated by 45 degrees. So this is, this is basically the very general argument that if our if the cosmological perturbations are linear and the basic degree of freedom is scalar, then when you project a scalar onto the celestial sphere, you just get a scalar. So you cannot
make any B-modes, then we see factors which are the K can make scalars and factors, and tensors can make both scalars and factors on the sphere. So the vectors are basically the B modes. So you have a very, to the extent that you have linearity, this is a very clean signal for tensor degrees of freedom. So it's basically the polarization that you're sensitive to. So with inflation, as was discussed, we just plot a potential. You only probe a small part of the spectrum, because we only see a few e-faults with the scalar perturbation. So we don't really know what the height of the potential is. So this is almost like an integration constant. Whereas with the tensors, what we're really measuring is the Hubble constant at the time the relevant mode left the horizon. So we're measuring H, or if it's caused by a field, we're measuring the potential directly. So as long as you believe gravity, you don't have some modifications of gravity, this is very clean and model independent. Yeah, so here we, I'll skip this. So if we sort of think about, well, what are going to be future tests of inflation? So this is a bit of a negative point of view. Well, many of the predictions of inflation really preceded inflation. I mean, we know these sort of very general properties of the universe, and inflation provides a very beautiful explanation, but it's not really clear if these are real tests. With the scalar perturbations, well, it's very, inflation provides a very satisfying explanation why one has approximate scale invariance. But this prediction preceded inflation. It's very satisfying that the perturbations are Gaussian, as predicted by inflation. But then you could also say, well, this is just evidence of weak coupling physics at play, if one wants to be negative. The primordial character of the cosmological perturbations, well, topological defects provided us with a scale invariant spectrum, but perturbations were constantly produced. And here we see that the perturbations were imprinted very early on. In a sense, the tensors are the, this is a really unique prediction of inflation, particularly the redness of the tensor spectrum. So this is really a test with these most inflationary potentials. The universe expanded very fast, and we physics close to the Planck scale was at play. And this is a very direct way of testing this prediction. This is why this is so important.
Yeah.
yes, you can make models of inflation without detectable tensor perturbations if you have a variance.
So that's not really a false.
It's not a model, it's an idea. It's falsified ideas. You can't figure out whether the details are.
But in any case, it would be very, it would.
If you follow them, it's great. If you don't, you can't necessarily conclude.
You can't rule out inflation.
Right.
You would know a lot about spring cosmology you would want, et cetera. So I completely agree with you. So, when you propose an experiment, people would like a prediction of what. Or the chances of seeing something, or almost a promise, and that's somewhat difficult to do. So I'm going to show two approaches that give quite different answers. So here we have the approach of Boyle, Steinhardt, and Turok, who basically say that you the value of R above below ten to the minus two is extremely unlikely. So basically, what they do is, in addition to all the other requirements, they say, well, we're going to assume that the potential is analytic, expandable in a power series near the minimum, and I think this is sort of an instructive exercise, because even though this might not be true, and one can make potentials that are other of another form, you really learn something if that's so. So this is very encouraging, and this is sort of the optimistic prediction. Then we also have this sort of Bayesian distribution over potentials, where we get sort of what looks like a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram with a tail that goes to R arbitrarily small. And to be fair, we really there's this. and in the collaboration, there was a lot of heated discussion about this. And I think in the end, all we can conclude is that you really have to go out and look. And it's really, and that if some of these low models are true, that one would learn something. So how do you make a model with very low R? You have a very flat potential, and then inflation sort of goes over a waterfall and stops ends very suddenly. And that's definitely possible. But we would learn something. Here's a plot of the basically all the CNB anisotropies for the best fit WMAP model. So the important thing to notice the logarithmic scale. So the scalars are in green, and the tensors are in blue, in the tensor modes. And here is the gravitational lensing. So there are a few things that, so this is our E modes that are basically already known because they arise from the scalar sector.
and you have lenses between the last scattering surface and us that sort of distort the celestial sphere, and we'll turn some of those into B modes. Now this, the low L part of the spectrum is basically a white noise spectrum. And it's easy to understand why. The lenses are very small. So there's basically, at low L, just one number that characterizes the lenses. And then if we would follow this, well, here you can see it sort of turns over up here. So this L gives you the size of the lenses. If we plot detector noise, we'll see that it has approximately the same shape. So this is a bit difficult, makes it easy to confuse the two. Then here we have various tensor mode spectra where the T over S is an unknown parameter. So this is sort of the height of the potential. And you know that that's scale invariant when T over S is small. So you can see that if we had a perfect measurement, that one gets the best signal to noise per ALM over here in this so-called reionization bump part of the spectrum. And here they're almost parallel, but here the tensor modes turn over a lot earlier. So you can distinguish them by the shape. And if we don't consider any sort of cleaning, we could sort of just calculate a detection capability, just considering this noise with cosmic variance. If you make very accurate maps of the EE scalar mode, and if you're able to reconstruct the gravitational lensing spectrum, then you can, there have been a lot of papers on this. You can subtract this off at ALM. But to do that, you basically need a much higher sensitivity and much higher resolution, because you have to have this EE all the way up to 1,000. So there are basically two natural types of B-mode experiments that suggest themselves. One, where you, much more ambitious, where you try to go to arc minute scale and you try to clean the lensing. And then less ambitious, where you have sort of a degree scale or half degree scale resolution, where you just try to characterize this lensing and just see it as noise and detect the B modes in light of that. Yes?
Doesn't that lead you to different classes of experiment? Your answer to that question?
Well, I haven't talked about foregrounds yet. So foregrounds presumably can be subtracted to a certain degree because they have a different spectrum. Whereas here, the gravitational lensing is achromatic. So if you can't subtract that, it's always there as noise, a foreground or something on top of that. But if you don't subtract it,
I thought Liner said there's a consensus you're not going to get below that second blue line, basically, because it's working.
Just to say one thing, the house from the West report, now I understand your earlier question. So that was from the West report, and that was mostly focused on large angular scales over most of the stock. So foreground limit is not so much that R equals 2 limit due to foregrounds is not yet a well-studied question for LM8. The limit of R of 0.01 due to foregrounds is widely believed for L less than 20. The limit of R of 0.01 due to foregrounds.
So if you want to get that second bump in the BB spectrum, you might imagine really honing in on cleaning up the lensing, and then the foreground would be less of an issue at L of 100 or something like that.
Yeah, so, right. And so the plot I showed foregrounds, if you focus on a good part of the sky, foregrounds are less of an issue at L of 100. But then, as you can see, the lensing comes in at R of 0.01, and the lensing is a large to, large scale, to small scale coupling.
Which is pretty well understood.
So depending on how you design your experiment, you stop there because of the lensing.
I mean, I don't think it's clear that it is interesting as the cleaning is. One doesn't know whether the foregrounds will allow you to get below that. So.
Yeah, no. Less studied in those things.
But does the European community believe that just focus on a large L, the first bump, that low L, that you can't get below R minus 2?
No, wait a minute. I'm just trying to explain the salient points. The peak in the information is around an L is equal to 50. But you have basically two opportunities. You have this bump, you have this bump, and then if you don't clean, then this is sort of like a noise that you can't get around. Okay, here you get shows you for different optical depths the reionization bump. Basically, the way to understand the reionization bump is if you want to make a rough order of magnitude estimate of the polarization on large angular scales, well, even this gradient is due to the Doppler shift or whatever, so this is fixed. That even though very few photons scatter from reionization, this length is much larger. So you get this bump, but then there's sort of an averaging effect, so it only affects the first few L. Okay, this plot shows the signal to cumulative signal to noise squared for the reionization bump. And the thing to take away, which is sort of one of the weaknesses of this window, is basically how much it's concentrated in the first few multipoles. So you really have to understand the galaxy, and you don't have many opportunities to sort of subdivide the data, etc. This is really a low L phenomena. On the other hand, you have this huge amplification factor. Let's see. This shows you basically with the lensing where the lensing comes from. So at low out, we can sort of look at this integral, and you can see how far up you have to go in knowing the lensing potential in E in order to do the cleaning.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
As far as using the low L window to see the B mode, right? The question I have is about the degeneracy. Essentially, what you really want to measure is the primordial tensor signal. How well are you going to be able to resolve the degeneracy between R and tau, essentially, if all you're measuring is the orthotic pulse? Because the primordial signal is really low, and you're measuring mostly the effect of the reionization. So how good are you going to be at really measuring R and not some combination of R and tau at that scale?
Well, it's not, I mean, the uncertainty of tau would give you some uncertainty not in having seen something. I mean, tau will never give you a B mode if T over S is equal to zero. So in terms of
that's
making
true.
A
but
detection,
how long you
that's not
all
good.
All you care about is the detection. I see. Okay, I understand.
You can't drop from the E mode. You know that.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, is just how well, if that's all you have, is how well can you resolve the degeneracies there and measure R once you have a detection?
If you can measure B to that level,
yeah. You
got tau nailed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to prove that we can detect something. And, I mean, that one has a good chance of detecting something and believing that it's not zero. That would be a second order question. Here we can also look at if we forget about the reionization bump, then where is the information? So you basically use this as a noise, and then with a perfect experiment or a realistic experiment, you want to make a curve like this. And of course, at higher out, you have many more multiples, but then the signal is swamped by this lensing. And you'll find that most of the information is center, half of it is below L is equal to 50. And there's really very little beyond 80. So this is sort of a good thing. This means that you can search for B modes with an experiment with very coarse angular resolution. This might be a little exaggerated because you don't have, or unlikely to have, a very accurate absolute calibration. So you want to see part of this turnover where the lensing starts to dominate. We can also sort of graphically, this is an experiment where the instrument noise has been made to sort of lie approximately in the same order of magnitude as the lensing, and then you have two different beam sizes. And then you can graphically divide by L to sort of show what you would be able to do with broad binning. And then this is the sensitivity without foregrounds. So to sort of take into account the uncertainty in the gravitational lensing, one thing, I mean, we don't know exactly the template for the gravitational lensing. We can, if we do a Fisher analysis, we can sort of estimate what the effect of this uncertainty is. And then this was for, this isn't the current B pulse, isn't this good, but this sort of
can give you an order of magnitude. There are other ways to, I mean, one can float the normalization and see what is the effect of that. And so if you sort of come up with a set of requirements, well, what would you want a depolarization experiment to do that doesn't aim to clean? Well, you want to match the sensitivity to match the lensing. So this is about 13 times more sensitive than Planck. So you would need 13 squared times the integration time. You want a coarse angular resolution suffices. So you don't need to deploy a large mirror into space. So that provides some cost saving. But since the signal is that you're looking for has almost a white noise spectrum, you really need excellent control of systematic errors. So you need to compare distant parts of the sky very quickly, because unlike in something in a temperature experiment, you have more problems on the large scales than on the small scales. And you want the full sky coverage to be able to take advantage of the reionization bump. So ideally, we would like to make two detections, one at L is a few, and one is L is equal to 50. And you can almost think of these as two separate experiments in one experiment that have different problems. And you need broad frequency coverage because foregrounds are a big problem. So let's see. So the people instrument is, I mean, this is sort of cut away. The basic idea is that the only way to greatly increase the sensitivity, since one is limited by photon counting statistics, is to increase the number of detectors. So there are two approaches, the bolometer arrays, which is something of the future, or here the decision was to have a large number of horns. And independent telescopes with lenses going from, well, really 70 to 360 gigahertz. There are two horns at 45. With a 15-degree angular resolution to try to control synchrotron better. So the reason for the separate telescopes is for the it's difficult to make anti-reflective coatings that work well for all these frequencies. And here is the for the frequencies, the angular resolutions, the number of detectors here, and the sensitivities. This formula basically indicates how you. The dependence on the number of detectors. Okay, so this the bolometers have to be cooled and in several stages, like blank, and then the heat has to be guided away. So there are these V grooves for each of the stages, and then this is a possible chirostat. This is actually from the French Saint-Pont project. One of the aspects that's very important is to, since it's really the low L multiples that are important, is to, rather than having a scanning strategy like Planck, where one has many circles in mostly in the same direction, to have something highly redundant like this with a precession and mutation. So this is after one day. And then 1 month of observation, and then after a year. And another aspect, so you can see that they cross many times, giving you lots of cross checks. And then this diagram shows that this is a measure of sort of the non-uniformity of how, which direction you ideally you want to go through a pixel in as many different ways as possible. So this is a measure to which a certain line is preferred. And this is, I think, 10 to the minus 8 or something. So this is Planck, and this is Beeple. So it's very uniform, which facilitates data analysis greatly. Here's some foreground plots from Carlo Borregana. And let's see. So I'm going to show you, this is a sort of, to get an idea of the foregrounds are basically, I would say this is the best one could do. I mean, we had to come up with some numbers and figures, and there were foreground codes run, but to make something order of magnitude, you can assume that you have three components, which you know you have, synchrotron, CMB, and dust, and fix the spectral indices. So the spectral properties are completely known. And then with your detectors and resolution, you can see, well, what will be the noise from the foregrounds with this model. So of course, this is not a good model because we know the synchrotron spectral index varies from point to point, and the dust has different properties and temperatures, et cetera. But under these assumptions, this is what you get, and then you divide by 1 over L, and you can sort of see, get a rough idea. This is goes down because of the 45 gigahertz horns with a 15 degree resolution. That really helps sort of nail the synchrotron. So let me explain these numbers. I'm not going to say that suggesting that these are the numbers of what people will be able to do. That this I can tell you quite precisely how we got these numbers. So as a guideline, we can sort of think of the idealized experiment with no foregrounds, no instrument noise, just the contamination from lensing. And you, if you have this, you get this amazing, you would get this amazing sensitivity from the reionization bump. And if you just look at the larger multipoles, this is what you get. So then if we use the nominal sensitivity, so we just take the two central channels, then these are the sensitivities that you get from the reionization bump and without. So in theory, the reionization bump, if you can overcome all of the problems of systematic errors and foregrounds, this is, I mean, it's a very powerful probe. Okay, the optimistic foreground model, where we raise the noise, then we get these numbers, and we can compare to Planck, and this is very optimistic because this doesn't take any systematics. This just takes the sort of published instrument noise. For a more realistic projection, we can do the Fisher analysis, where we have all of these parameters. And let's see. Then these are the numbers that you get. So this is within a factor of two of Lyman's number. Well, that's what we're—that's what one would hope, that is one learns more about foregrounds and one has better data, than the number of components and properties of the components can vary. Now, what I think the thing to take away is that. I mean, one is going to collect the data that's sort of needed, and one has a chance at these sensitivities, but the precise foreground properties, I mean, we don't really know the properties, so we can't, we're reluctant. I'm just giving you these numbers and explaining how they're calculated, and what could be wrong with them. They're not realistic. These are all very optimistic. That's the best that Planck. That's the best that Planck could possibly do.
It's the best. He's taking into account everything what we know about foregrounds, etc., etc. If we don't expect something clear, then 0.17 could be detected by Planck. If nothing, that will happen.
Well, why are there two numbers?
You have 0.17, you have 0.36. What is the difference? Because it's really tremendous. Because what I would expect 0.17 is, okay, is prediction.
One includes L less than 15, one doesn't.
Yeah, this is. But this is the serious, this is the more serious of the two numbers. So you have with the very naive foreground model, you have a really interesting sensitivity to reionization, but this is not. I mean, this is just from BMUDs. This isn't interesting. Because I mean, one can already do this from the.
I'm having trouble reading this because it does seem to me like there's four values for Q over S.
Yeah.
So the 5 to 10 to the minus 2 is at L out of 100, and that's the. Is that right? And 0.36 is. What are those two numbers?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the reionization bump, which is L less than 15.
Okay. But if you put that includes all F, not just L. The second one doesn't include L less than 15, is that right?
That's well, most of the signal comes from the first few L. If you include everything, you would get the same number. But then if you mask out the reionization bump, this is what you would get.
So the second number is the best you could do if there were no reionization at all.
You said it's no reionization.
Yes.
Or if that's how we're supposed to read it.
Or if you don't have around the experiment that's working well at L less than 20.
Well, let's go. Yeah, this is Planck bin. And you can see that, it goes down quite a bit here, but it's really very modest here.
So, and this reionization corresponds to these optical depths, which people now, okay, reionization part, you calculate, yeah? To which optical depths it corresponds? At each redshift, in fact.
The max 3-year dining everything. So 0.07.
Okay.
Okay, so there's also competition from the ground. And here's a spectrum of from the South Pole, where you have the optical depth of the emission. And as you can see, that there are a lot of lines in the interesting range. And to get thus, you need to be around here. And moreover, you get the polarization from the magnetic field in the oxygen line. So you have to choose your
channels very carefully, and you have a lot of problems. And this spectrum varies. From the ground also, you have a lot of problems with the far side lobes. And I mean, because at L2, the Earth is very tiny, and you can block the sun with diffraction-limited shields, whereas from the ground, you always have diffraction over the shields because the hot ground extends to the horizon. If it were a little under the horizon, the situation might be different. You're very restricted in a scanning strategy because you always have to scan at the constant zenith angle, so one can't make an interlocking redundant scan pattern. Yes. there are other problems that are likely to become more severe as the sensitivity is increased. So people like to say, and typically say, well, yes, the atmosphere glows, but it's not polarized. But any sort of backscattering is going to be highly polarized. And there's, for example, an interesting paper by Pietro Nera talking about the ice crystals. So if you want to, you could make a sort of estimation of, well, what is the backscattered power from the polarization of the sunlight? But if you, what you're really worried about is sort of large scatterers. And to get an idea of the sort of magnitude of the requirement, well, we characterize the white noise by five microkelvin arc minutes. So then you sort of ask, well, what for the what temperature difference would that correspond on the quadrupole? And you get something in the order of nanokelvin. So even a very tiny, minute optical depth backscattering will change unpolarized photons into polarized photons. And moreover, something like that is going to have a coherent structure because it's the polarization ideally would always point toward the zenith, so it would be coherent over your circles and could be varying. So there are a lot of things to worry about. And with the far side lobes, I mean, this is a very light diffracts by large angles, which it necessarily does, it's polarized. So it's not clear, do you want to make your ground shields completely reflecting, in which case sharp structures would tend to polarize, or do you want to have something very absorbing, like EchoStor. So we don't really know how serious these problems are going to be, but there are many experiments underway, and there are really a lot of interesting ideas. And one of the things discussing BPOL is that people came with very ambitious technologies at the beginning and wanted to make this big instrument with the most advanced detectors. And then when reads the ESA guidelines that things need to be proven, and the overall design is rather conservative. So, it'll be interesting to see how these new technologies and ideas for modulation develop. Let's see. Well, I'm out of time, so I think I'll just conclude. And thank you.
Reconstruct
the lensing field using higher-order correlations in the CMB. Is that going to be a problem for the your more optimistic measurements of R?
No, we're assuming no reconstruction, because as our angular resolution is sort of 45 arc minute. You need arc minute resolution to do that for reconstruction. So the name of the game here is to just perfectly characterize the power spectrum, but not the ALMs, and that's easy to do. I mean, you know what the shape is from this theory, from the scalar part of the spectrum. The shape is very different. So this is something we can be sure that we can deal with. Foregrounds is much more difficult.
I have a quick question about maybe a wishful thinking question, but are there any constraints you can put on the tilt of the gravity limit, or is that well beyond anyone's wildcat?
Well, constraints, yes. Whether there are interesting constraints from analyzing inflationary potentials, probably not. But we have these two rather sharp windows. So sort of if you say the reionization bump is around L is equal to 5, and the detection at the larger L is at around 50, have a sort of factor of 10 lever arm. So you go get some constraints and see if it's the two are consistent with each other, and if you get the red spectrum.
Are you sure about that? I thought you couldn't constrain it to the CNC below. You have to go all the way out. Maybe I misunderstood it. I stuck for enough degeneracy that you can't, even with those few bumps, can't do it. Yeah, Mark.
I don't. If you get to, I mean, there are two window functions, right?
For sure. There are two features, but they're not too generous to really to get any. You can get the amplitude, but you can't separately go and get in some keys. You really do that. You have to go to the gravitational wave. Measured on no EVO or something.
Well, you'll get some constraint on what the tilt could be. Right.
No. You'll get a measurement at low L and a measurement at high L. But the underlying spectrum that's placed into that, if there are other things in that spectrum than the underlying spectrum index. So those two measurements. Isn't that what you're saying?
Right? Yeah, okay. I think
those
think
two measurements.
I don't think
the low L measurement and the next bump is not enough information to say what's the underlying power law.
I mean, if you have two, you have two window functions that are well, completely well defined.
Yeah.
If you know the.
It's not the measurement.
It's one of the things. I could draw a straight line between it, but I noticed none of your spectrum look like a straight line. It's got all these bumps and so forth. And so if I want to ask what's the shape of the seed spectrum, which is a power bump, then I need to know the origin of every bump and wiggle and take that out. Okay. And so I need other information.
Well, I think the underlying spectrum will be so close to flat that
sure,
you won't be able to measure interesting deviations from that flatness. You won't be able to compare with theories, but you'll be able to ask, well, are these two measurements consistent with each other? So I think I'm agreeing with you on that.
Let's not scientific question. If you would get tomorrow money, okay, when you would publish the first paper of decoupling on decoupled polarization, how long should you need besides of money for making this experiment?
How
long time?
If money were not a limitation.
Yeah.
If money would be a limit,
how would I start?
It's a meaningless question. Because you just built 5 of every idea we have, you'd launch them all, and you'd get the result in 10 years. Or
yeah,
or 7 years.
But
no,
but
that doesn't say money's not enough. You get a reasonable amount of one experiment.
Yeah. How long did it take? 5 years?
7 years.
He said seven.
Seven.
7 years times the sum factor of the number of people on the table.
Which way does that factor go?
More
yes.
Time or more people.
It's faster than that.
Well,
it probably has a decrease in that.
Yeah. Right. Well, you can't do it with one.